happening now that the nation is reviving its interest in full employment to an interesting crunch, to the place where an entitlement program, if you're unemployed and you've worked before, you're entitled to unemployment insurance, is coming smack dab against the kind of problems we've dealt with on a very inadequate patchwork basis in creating just a few neighborhood youth corps jobs, never enough. We're documenting the need those years, never enough. And of course, nothing at all, speak of during the wintertime. Those few, 310,000 public service jobs during a time when there's 7 million unemployed. We're now coming to the point where we're thinking about full employment, and we're going to say we're going to turn some of that unemployment insurance money into jobs. No secret why the administration's likes unemployment insurance. It costs you roughly $4,000 per person. If you're talking about jobs, you're talking about something like $7,500 in pay, another 10% in cost. Are you proposing, Ms. Rivlin, when you talk about using unemployment insurance money for jobs, entitling everybody who's unemployed over a period of time to get a job for $7,500 a year? Then you're saying that that after you've been unemployed a certain time, you'll get a job at roughly twice what the government's putting into your unemployment insurance benefit. I think that's the kind of real problem that we ought to be wrestling with this afternoon.
May I just object, though, to get the question right? It isn't only unemployment compensation that that person gets. They get food stamps, and they get they get other kinds of supplementary income.
How they can be worked out, and I was not proposing a job guarantee, really. You definitely have the same problem when you guarantee a job, it has to be guaranteed at a specific wage. If the wage is high enough, I would consider a living income, there is the danger of having a growing and accumulating number of people working under the guaranteed job program. If it's not high enough, it is simply a temporary expedient, then it doesn't solve the problem of those who really are not employable in the private sector. There are all these problems.
Do you disagree with the husband that if they had to go fund the private sector, that problem unemployability
part? Oh, this is a matter of degree. It's partly a question of defining full employment. If Dr. Kaiserling is clearly right that if we were running as tight a labor market as we ran in World War II, then a lot of the unemployability would disappear. It did then, it would again, even at higher skill levels. When companies are out searching for people to fill jobs that must be filled, they lower standards and they take on training costs themselves. I think that we know from the past. And there's some ability to learn from the past. The question of whether, the real question now is two things. It's could we run as tight a labor market as World War II without rapidly escalating inflation? We did then have wage and price controls. We would have had to have had them, or we would have had very rapid inflation in the World War II period. Now, within limits, they did work. But it was a nation at war. It was an emergency situation. And I think we very frankly don't know whether wage and price controls as a long-time peacetime thing would work or not, but there's grave reason to doubt that one could maintain that kind of a situation for very long without grave distortions or wholesale violations of a wage price control system. But the other thing is, even in the process of getting the unemployment rate down, there are clearly several different ways of doing it. And I think we need a mix of policies, some fiscal and monetary stimulation, and some efforts to create jobs directly, both temporarily and on a longer term basis, as ways of integrating people who are not necessarily permanently unemployable, but certainly less employable than other people, into the labor
force. Dr. Heller?
Mr. Chairman, since this is my only shot, do you mind if I sort of give you three for the price of one?
That's me, great.
I'd like to answer, or at least address myself, to Leon, Kaiserling, and Mr. Frankel, and Professor Spring, all three. First of all, let me say that while Leon and I may have a different reading of economic history and its implications for the future, I have to say when he tells us that the main solvent of unemployment is a strong national expansionary policy, you know, right on. That's absolutely right. That is the, and that addresses itself to the question you were raising. If you want to get the disadvantage, it's a terrible word, it covers a lot of sins. If you want to get the disadvantaged employed, the best single motivation to mobilize is the self-interest of employers. And the way you mobilize that self-interest is to operate the economy at very high levels of demand. Two ways about it. Because then they themselves will reach down to the bottom of the job barrel and give people jobs and give them training and build the human capital. And you do it without any bureaucracy. You do it without any human beings making a decision in Washington about it. You do it because it is to the self-interest of the private economy. And in that, we share entirely the same objectives. I feel you ought, therefore, to accompany the employment programs with programs, with measures to lower the inflation proneness of the economy so that you don't have to do what we did in World War II, and I think your example is an entirely relevant one. We got black unemployment, as I recall, down to 0.5% without any compulsory measures. But as Alice Rivlin says, it took a blanket of wage price control. Our, you know, the challenge to ingenuity is how to do it without that blanket of wage price control. Now next, talking about the Job Corps and about the poverty program, in which I, in spite of some of the difficulties, am happy to claim a certain paternal interest. It's an irony that the kind of standards that were developed for testing programs, developed by Alice Rivlin, among others, and she has pointed out this irony, should have been applied, in a sense, for the first time to these programs. We used to judge a program by, did the agency get the money, spend it quickly and spend it for the, I mean, spend it promptly in accordance with the congressional intent. Now we've developed more sophisticated measures. You know, what's the output we get for a given input? And what were the first victims of that? Job Corps and the poverty programs. I'm not saying this is not an argument for not improving our delivery systems. This is just saying that they were judged by harsher standards than any social programs this country ever had. And it distresses me, as I said in my statement, that so many of my colleagues, liberal and conservative alike, talk about some of these programs and point out all the things we're doing wrong and how much it costs and all the difficulties, instead of still recognizing that we must flank fiscal and monetary policy with direct job programs, and the assignment should be to do them better, not to give up because we've done them poorly, in the same way with manpower programs.
In fact, the problem was not that those programs didn't work, but there wasn't enough of them, and there weren't the jobs which weren't their responsibility to create in the first place at the other end often. But the Job Corps itself had a splendid record in-house of increasingly the human capital, as it were. People gone through the Job Corps are in much better shape than when they went in. The problem comes getting them jobs in the outside economy.
The chairman of this session had an awfully good figure of speech not long ago, without mixing metaphors. Besides, he had he said you can't cure pneumonia with 25,000 units of penicillin a day, and to call penicillin failure because 25,000 units wouldn't cure pneumonia is, of course, a complete non sequitur.
And might I add that if you also have tuberculosis and anemia at the same time, which is about the comparison that you're talking about here, because when you're directing certain programs that we're talking about, like the poverty programs, to whom were they directed? To the illiterate? To the people with no background, no experience, the people that had lived in poverty and had lived in ugliness, and all at once you expect that just by a normal little injection that it's going to lift them up. And here you go around and take the brightest kids that you got from the nicest families you had and send them off to the greatest university and they flunk. And the rate of dropout in the job corps wasn't a bit higher than it was in Harvard. Not a bit. Or that it is at an average state university. But we judge these poor people. And we judge them because they're black and brown and poor. We judge them one way, because most of them that went in there were minorities, and they were poor people. And we put one standard on them, and we take our own kids, and they have trouble in school, and they say, well, it's the teacher's fault, or, you know, or something else. I know what it costs.
They're just finding themselves.
Or they're just having struggle. They're struggling finding themselves, or their mother didn't understand them, or something else.
Well,
I'm not good on statistics, but on feeling.
And you're awfully good on metaphors. Now, I just want to add one other quick word, and that is that I agree with the comments that were made that when you're talking about using some of these social insurance funds, unemployment insurance funds for direct job creation, you have to broaden your calculus. You have to take into account the other costs, as someone has already suggested. And it seems to me you have to take into account the product. If you create jobs and they're producing something in the job, that somehow or another may not get into the individual calculus, but it certainly ought to get into the national calculus.
All right, we'll ask for our next participant here, and we have Mr. O'Malley. Mr. O'Malley, you represent small business, and we're very happy to have you here. We had you, I believe, was it in Providence or what?
Fall River.
Fall River. Oh, at Margaret, that's right.
That's correct.
That was a great year. Go ahead.
I wish to thank you for the opportunity of being here and inviting you, Mr. Chairman. I have to admit a certain amount of distress sitting here today. And the distress is caused by the fact that until you used the term small business in introducing me, that term has not been used by any of our panelists or discussants. And I've long maintained that the small businessman is one of the most ignored and discriminated against individuals in the United States. In many ways, they've suffered some of the same injustices that the minorities have suffered that we've been referring to. And in that sense, I am upset. First of all, I don't have any prepared statements. I'd just like to make some off-the-cuff observations. I think that we've got to be careful about a few things. In discussing the area of public service employment, I think we're making a serious mistake if we look upon this as being a long-term remedy for any individual. And I'd like to discuss this not so much in terms of general economic theories, but how does it apply to a specific individual, to a person, to a human being? It would seem to me that a human being going into a government service employment job should not be going in there with the idea that this is going to be his career. He should go in there with the idea that I'm going to learn a skill and I'm going to get myself into the private sector, either as a self-employer or as an employee, but I'm not going to stay in this program for a great many years. I'm going to get myself out of here. And I think if we adopt the approach that this program, government service area programs, should be a long-term solution for a particular individual, we're making a very serious mistake. I think we're stripping that individual of his dignity and self-respect. I'd like to point out once again, as I did in Fall River, the role that the small businessman plays in the American economy. And perhaps when I get through pointing that out, you'll understand, as I'm sure you do, Senator and Mrs. Heckler, the disconcerting feeling that I have right now. In the United States, there are 13 million American companies which make up the small business community. They account for 97% of all American firms, 43% of all American business output, 33% of the gross national product, and here's the hooker as far as I'm concerned, 52% of all private employment. And not once today have I heard anything as to how we can improve the employment picture with regards to programs for small businesses. I have to admit, I was somewhat elated to read on page 11 of the proposed Humphrey-Hawkins bill, a statement which says, priority policies and programs to support full employment and balanced growth shall initially include, one, development of energy, transportation, food, small business, and environmental improvement policies and programs required for full employment and balanced economic growth. I think that should be a real mainstay of the bill, particularly with respect to the small businessman, in view of the fact that 52% of all private employment comes out of that sector. As I pointed out previously, I think the small businessman has been long-suffering, he's been abused, he's been neglected by governmental policies. We can start with tax policy. The Senate Select Committee on Small Business states that large corporations pay only about 25% of their income in federal taxes because of loopholes, while the small and medium-sized firms pay 48% level. That's a national disgrace. Secondly, I'd like to point out that one area where the small businessman has been totally neglected, in my opinion, is in the monopolistic area, the area of predatory practices engaged in by large corporations. To reduce it to its simplest human terms, the next time you pull in to buy gas at the gasoline station dealer, ask him who owns the business. Does he own it, or does Mobil, Exxon, Shell, Gulf, or any of the other large oil corporations? In all probability, he'll answer, I just leased this place, and they own me, they control me, I can't do anything about that. Well, that's wrong. We hear these complaints regularly. We hear them from drugstore operators, from people in the pharmaceutical business, where chain stores are taking over the drug industry in the areas that we represent. We heard it 15 years ago, perhaps, in the food industry, where the so-called mar and pa stores were being driven out of business by the large food chains. And the food chain said back then, well, this is being done in the interest of providing lower prices to the consumer. Well, we're paying higher prices for food than we ever paid before. A small businessman is being discriminated against by governmental regulation, which is poorly thought out in many ways. A typical example that I hear frequently cited to me is the Pension Reform Act. While the goals of the Pension Reform Act are laudable, to protect an employee who puts in many years of service and finds that the funds have gone to Switzerland instead of into his own account, and he ends up with no retirement benefits, it seems to me that the paperwork involved, there's an unfair burden placed upon the small businessman. And the end result in this governmental policy is that the small businessman and the people that I talk to, in many respects, are canceling their pensions, their pension benefits. Their employees are therefore suffering by not having pension benefits when they retire. Senator Kennedy related an interesting story at the hearing in Fall River dealing with OSHA. It dealt with a Massachusetts small businessman who was in the meat processing area. One day his plant was visited by an OSHA inspector who informed him that the floors in the plant were in violation of OSHA regulations. And this was because the floors were smooth, they were a linoleum type floor. He was informed that it would be necessary to put steel gratings on the floor for the safety of his employees. To the tune of $20,000, he complied with this demand by the OSHA inspector. A few weeks later, he was visited by a federal employee from the Department of Health, who informed him that metal gratings in his type of factory were unsatisfactory. They had to be pulled out. He needed a smooth floor so that it could be adequately cleaned and the public could be protected in buying meat, making sure the meat was clean. Well, these things all point out to me that governmental regulation is a serious problem. But I hope to point out in my statement about monopolistic practices that in some ways we don't have enough governmental regulation. The large corporations are getting away with murder. They're harming the small businessman by this, and I hope to see some activity by federal and state governments in the near future. Now, I'd just like to direct a general question to the panelists, and that is this. First of all, why haven't you mentioned the small businessman, the man who accounts for the greatest number of employees in the private sector? Why haven't you mentioned him directly in your remarks? And secondly, what do you propose to do to increase the viability of the small business sector so that more people will be brought into it, not only as employees, but as employers?
Dr. Hotker, why don't we start with you on that? And then we'll come down, take it down the line, and any of you wish to respond.
Well, let me point out that although I didn't use the word small business, I have in fact referred to this, and at the outset of my remarks I said that our political and economic system derives its strength from widely dispersed private initiatives. Now this, I think, implies a lot of things, that small business has an important role to play in this. I am also concerned about the practices of certain large corporations, and I feel that more effort is needed to ensure competition. Small business is by and large competitive. I say by and large because there are exceptions too. Some anti-competitive practices originate in small business and have to be condemned even though they already originate there. But I'm convinced of the need to foster small business consistent with a reasonable degree of efficiency. There are certain types of operations that cannot compete anymore, and I would not want to see those preserved artificially. If the disappearance of small business is the result of an abuse of power, then I would certainly be in favor of remedying that. If the chairman will permit me, I would like to make one other point in connection with the questions raised by the other two discussants. Especially concerning youth unemployment. This is obviously a very serious problem, and I wouldn't want my own remarks to be understood as saying that there should be no effort by the government in this area. I think it's very important that the government does deal appropriately with this very serious problem. I would also point out, though, that the problem is aggravated by two things which the government tolerates or imposes and which have an aggravating effect on this serious problem. The first one of these is the minimum wage law as presently constituted. The fact that there is no exception or no lower rate for young people. The fact is that many young people could find work at lower wage rates, but they just aren't worth the $3 an hour or so, which in total is presently required by an employer to give them work. Therefore, I believe that if there has to be a minimum wage law at all, it should give some recognition to younger people in the sense of permitting them lower wages. The second element of this is the labor unions, especially in the area of construction. I am not an opponent of the labor unions in general. I believe that if they are open, they can play a very useful role. But there are closed unions which restrict membership. A few months ago, I happened to see on television a picture of a line of about 3,000 young people who were standing all night in front of a union office, I believe it was somewhere on Long Island, because the local electricians union had announced that there were 500 job openings. There were 3,000 applicants. Now I ask you, what right does a union have to determine which of these 3,000 young people can become electricians? This is pure anti-competitive practice. It is, I believe, a major source of unemployment among the young.
Mr. Ginsburg, we'll just go down and let you all comment on each one of these observations here.
Well, I want to begin by saying I come from a town where there's only small business by and large. We have about 19 out of 20 employers in New York have less than 20 employees. We're a very splintered kind of an entrepreneurial community. One thing I didn't understand of you, Mr. Malley, was that it's not necessarily bad to be a franchisor. You ought to have a chance maybe to own your own local gas station but it's conceivable you could be better off by being a franchisor than by being an owner. So I just didn't want to let that pass by saying that because you're a franchisor is necessarily bad. I think a second problem with small business, and I think you were correct to challenge us as to why we didn't say something about it, was implied in one of my comments. A lot of small businesses are in the service area. And I would like the record to show, Senator Humphrey, that in the 2 days that I've listened, there have been periodic discussions about productivity here, which I think have failed to take account of the fact that we are an increasingly service economy, and we don't know how to measure output in the service sector. So that what we are doing is, I think, getting more and more distressed about our supposed slippage in productivity, carry the whole productivity. The most extreme form of that is, of course, the governmental sector, which now represents at a minimum a fifth of all the jobs. The way I count it, it really accounts for one-third of all the jobs in the United States. Now, the only way that we count productivity in that sector is by inputs. So you never have any gains in output. It's absolutely impossible. So that means that a lot of our statistical assumptions about this economy are very bad, as far as I'm concerned, on the productivity side. It just doesn't make any sense. We don't know how to figure a day's hospitalization 20 years ago, to use your medical one, and a day's hospitalization today in terms of the effectiveness of any of the outputs. On the minimum wage, I want to again have the record show something that it doesn't usually show. Number one, we are always accused of having a very high wage for the youngsters because the Europeans supposedly have special, and they do have special wages levels for the youngsters. However, if you take the ratio of youth wages to average wages in Great Britain, France, Germany, and so on, and you take it in this country, there's no difference. So that's a very important point, I think, to establish. Secondly, I'm sorry that my distinguished colleague from Harvard made a slight misstatement. It is possible to get special exemptions from the Secretary of Labor, about 200,000 worth per year, which he has at his jurisdiction, if you will show that the youngster that you're taking on is going to receive real training. Now, I think there's some logic in that. That is, that you give somebody you give the employer the right to pay a lower wage if he's going to make some investment in this youngster. Otherwise, I think it is not unfair for a union to say, look, we don't want to be undercut by kids, and therefore have our wage standards eroded. The third point I want to make is that the manpower programs have made funds available on OJT to the employer so that he can get back part of the cost of hiring these youngsters, if he would, because we will pay them, the government will pay for the training part of the cost. In my opinion, I've been having a running argument with my friend Arthur Burns now for 20 years on this. As far as I'm concerned, he's wrong on that point. Not that I think necessarily that we would, if you just thought about youth unemployment as the sole problem, that we would necessarily have the minimum wages we do, but given the total context of minimum standards, relatives, and ways of getting exemptions, I don't think I would personally pay much attention to it. That's at least as far as I can see that. Now, on the closed unions, I think one has to, just in fairness to the unions, look at the data of Dr. Hardecker and realize that while obviously they are still trying to control as much as possible those jobs, and they consider those jobs a property right. Nevertheless, if you look at the impact of the anti-discrimination laws and the administration, I've been impressed with the high percentage of blacks that have managed finally, belatedly, but nevertheless surely, to get into the union. So that if you look at the last 10 years and you ask me to point out a relatively good performance about anti-discrimination laws, I would have to take at least a large proportion, I wouldn't say every last construction union, but a large proportion of them. And the final point I want to make and remind everybody of, that by and large, the housing that gets done in the United States, which is housing in the suburb, is a non-unionized area. What we're talking about is commercial building. And there, the figures as reported, and that's what I have to go on, the U.S. Department of Labor stuff, we now have the minority groups up to about 10, 11, 12%. of the trainees in the formal apprenticeship program. And they used to be at 2-3%. So it's not yet as maybe as good as it ought to be, but it's much improved.
All right.
Mr. Malley, you have anything else that you wanted to say here? Might I suggest that we might have our colleagues, Congresswoman Heckler and Congressman Oslo, to ask some questions of you, of the panels and the discussions now, because we get a good deal that way. Congresswoman Heckler?
Yes, Mr. Malley, I know the same comments you made, and something that is quite obvious. But if you were to answer the question how we can deal with unemployment and take into account the needs of small business, what would your response be?
Small businesses are not so much capital intensive as they are people intensive. They're not investing their money so much into large machinery, they're investing their money into people. And this is why I think we have to look at it in its most human terms, and this is why the small business sector, in my opinion, can play a very significant role in bringing this country into an employment picture that will be acceptable. Certainly is not acceptable right now. I would urge, among other things, which I think is a somewhat unique idea, we talk about crime in the streets, and we've enacted legislation at the federal level which provides how many millions of dollars or billions of dollars, I don't know, to the cities and towns of the United States to fight crime in the streets through the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, the LEAA. Well, I say, as some people also use the term, we should fight crime in the sweets. Namely, we should begin to put some of the money that we're putting into programs such as LEAA into fighting the large corporations, and by encouraging our state attorneys general to become more progressive in going after predators, large corporations engaging in price fixing and other monopolistic practices. Having been an assistant attorney general in Massachusetts for a period of 5 years, I can express my own dismay at the fact that we just never had any money to go after many corporations which we felt from initial evidence were engaging in monopolistic practices and antitrust violations. I would encourage the federal government to make money available to the state attorneys general so that they can fight antitrust activities at the state level. I think that's very important. But with respect to small business, I don't want to overlook perhaps the most important area now, which exists right now, and that is there is a crying need for a federal jobs program. As I mentioned to Senator Humphrey, I heard him speak one time before, and he related that soon after he had returned from college, he was helping his father out in the drugstore back home. He said his father, after having had the opportunity to study under many distinguished economists in college, he said that a statement his father made one day proved to him that his father, a small businessman, was the best economist he'd ever met. And the statement was, if the customer doesn't have it, we're not going to get it. We've got to put money into people's pockets. And the only way you're going to do that, And to make it at an acceptable level is to have a good federal jobs program. But I strongly would resist on my own feelings about the dignity of each individual in human terms, I would strongly resist a federal jobs program that would merely make people full-time, permanent government service employees. There are many areas that this country is lacking in, where people can be put to work and do meaningful jobs, but the goal should really be to get them to stand on their own feet as soon as we possibly can. That is of the utmost importance. We're not just talking about the situation where people are having a hard time putting food on the table. We're talking about the dignity, the self-respect of the individual. And this is what the American Constitution is about, and this is what the American way of life should be about. And I have to admit, I do get somewhat distressed when we talk simply in terms of economic theories. We should be talking as much as possible about people and what we can do for people. And I think the small business sector can play a very significant role here.
I'd like to ask Mr.
Rivlin
something. We had, at our hearing in Boulder, testimony from three mayors, and one of the mayors spoke about the disincentive, which is disincentive of unemployment. Which has been brought up in many of the panelists' statements throughout our 2 days here. One mayor suggested that we tie unemployment payments to a public service employment job. How would that, how does that proposal strike you?
Well, I think there is some evidence that unemployment compensation has some disincentive effects. It's bound to. There's sort of no way you can design a system that does meet the legitimate need to give people income when they're unemployed, which doesn't to some extent reduce their incentive to find another job. The effect may be marginal, but it's bound to be there somewhat. It is probably very difficult to design a program which does require public service employment of all who have, say, exhausted their unemployment compensation benefits, because it's not easy to create the right kinds of jobs in the right places. But surely moving in that direction is very much worth exploring.
I am very concerned about unemployment, and I'm, especially after listening to the witnesses describe their own dilemmas, especially the individuals for whom unemployment, if they're unemployed, is 100% the depression for them, whether it's a recession for the rest of the economy or not. But I'm also concerned about inflation, and I'm trying to measure the trade-offs to determine what is really the soundest public policy, as well as the most humane. Now, what, in your estimation, would be the budgetary impact or the inflationary impact of the Humphrey-Harkins bill without further changes in other laws from which you could transfer payments? If we were merely to add this bill and pass it tomorrow, what would be the impact in terms of inflation as a result of that legislation?
Well, I don't think it's really possible to answer that question without more specifics on the Humphrey-Hawkins bill and what spending levels and programs would actually be entailed. However, one can think a little bit in terms of the unemployment targets.
Yes, if you targeted 3%, for example.
The earlier version of the Humphrey-Hawkins bill aspire to an unemployment rate of 3% in 18 months. Given where we then were, or even where we now are on unemployment, I think the sad fact is that it's not feasible by means now known to get to 3% unemployment in 18 months without taking unacceptable risks of escalating the inflation. But the authors of the bill have recognized that and have modified the target to 3% adult unemployment over 4 years, which is a much more modest target. And there probably does exist a combination of policies which could get to that target without unacceptable levels of inflation. But the real question after the if the Humphrey-Hawkins bill is enacted, is what combination of policies should that be? And I think that will surely be the next round of conversations in this committee and elsewhere.
May I ask what...
I'm the daddy of that bill on this side. I think you ought to know that the immediate cost is approximately $50 million. That's what the immediate cost is. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's right.
Now, the rest of it is a process that has... what it really does is mandate to the president, the Council of Economic Advisors, that they must start to design programs and policies, not federal employment programs per se, that's the end of the line, but fiscal and monetary and budgetary policies, tax policies, tax incentives, anything you can think of to stimulate the private economy so that it's got a kind of built-in self-discipline. The more that the private economy responds, the less the public costs. In other words, it's a sort of a good way of saying, it's like the Chinese pay their doctors in the old days. They didn't pay the doctor when you were sick, they paid the doctor when you were well. You had an incentive as a doctor to keep people well.
I'd also like to ask Ms. Rivlin how you would define acceptable levels of inflation. You use that as the yardstick to which you refer quite often.
Well, I think that's probably a weasel phrase like full employment. Surely, what is an acceptable level of inflation or unemployment is a matter of individual judgment, and that's part of what the whole debate in the Congress about budgetary policy is about. It's partly differences in the technical judgments about what the trade-off is. Excuse me, Dr. Kaiserlin. How much inflation one would expect at various levels of unemployment, but there is much more value question of what risks one is willing to take. And surely all of us, if asked 10 years ago, would have said that the current levels of both unemployment and inflation are absolutely unacceptable. But then the question is, what risks are you willing to take in terms of escalating inflation to get the unemployment rate down?
I see you're not willing to tell me what you would consider an acceptable level. As one who respects your judgment, I would like to have you respond if you would be willing to. What would you consider an acceptable level of inflation?
I'm not really sure that has an answer. At the moment, we are stuck with about 5 to 7%. There's not much we can do about it. I don't find that acceptable. And the question is really whether an additional 1% makes things so bad that one wouldn't want to take that risk, or an additional 2%. And I'm not sure I have an answer to that question. That really is a judgmental question before the Congress.
Please.
Stick my nose out by answering that question. I think that the average rate of inflation of 4% that we had during the 7 years, the 3% average rate that we had during the 7 years that I was on the Council of Economic Advisors, with a war that was larger relative to the size of the economy than the Vietnam War, and with all kinds of other problems, was not quite an acceptable rate, but it was pretty good. And I think that the rate that we got down to of 0.8%, which we got down to when we had 2.9% unemployment, and when the war was at its peak, is an acceptable rate. I think the 1.5% rate of inflation that we had for 6 years from 1961 to 1965, when unemployment was reduced from 6.8% to 3.8%, was a very, very acceptable rate. I think the current rate is absolutely intolerable. But that's not the main point. The main point is that inability to decide perfectly what is an acceptable rate is no reason why you don't have to set targets. And let me say something about targets on the 3% unemployment rate at the same time, because they are intimately connected. Now, Pontius Pilate was asked, what is the meaning of truth? And I say, nobody knows the absolute meaning of truth, but they know a big lie. And they can do something about it. And nobody knows what perfect justice is, but they know what rank, gross injustice is, and we have it all around, and we can do something about it. And you don't have to get into refined economic arguments as to whether the right rate of inflation is 3 or 2 or 1 or 3.5, or whether the right rate of unemployment is 3 or 3.5 or 2.5, to set targets, because if you don't set targets, you can't do anything about it. And you modify the targets as you go along. Now, Arthur Burns said, I expected him to say, and others have said, you can't, I think it was intimated here today, you can't really set a precise goal for unemployment because you have changing structures in the labor force, which has nothing to do with it. The changing structures affect the problem of how you get there. They don't affect whether 3% or 2% or 4% is right. They have nothing to do with it, yet everybody talks about it. Now, the really important thing, Congresswoman, is that we made the best records on getting unemployment down when we had goals. We had goals during World War II. We had a specific target during the Truman years, which I'm not bragging about. Walter Hell had a specific target when he got down from 6.8% to 3.5%. It was an interim target of 4%, and he got below it. If he hadn't had the goal, he wouldn't have known how to move. And furthermore, if you don't have the goal, you don't know what kind of policies to have. How can you know what kind of tax policy to have, or money policy, or any kind of policy, if you don't know where you want to go? You can't just say we want to do better.
But you know, we've had so many goals in housing, for example, all these years. The Congress sets goals, but doesn't always honor them. So setting goals is not an assurance in terms of the implementation of the goal.
You're
strategy
absolutely right. I tried to emphasize that in my original statement. We have promises to keep. But we shouldn't start criticizing the goals. We should start saying we've fallen down.
I don't disagree with you there. Mr. Ginsburg, I think you have a comment on this too.
You weren't here when I made the point earlier of quoting one of Dr. Irwin's figures, which was to the effect that we have $47 billion of current appropriations that are floating around, most of which are being used to keep people out of work. They're just being used currently to support people. Now, the first point I want to make in that is that a lot of the comparisons between UI and PSE, about which the Commission's been very cautious on PSE, but I just want to point out that the UI-PSE comparisons have to be adjusted to get some real figures there, because the UI, as you know, doesn't carry any tax liability on the person who earns it. And moreover, there is some output, as I think Leon said earlier, to the PSE, even if the worst something comes out that you want to put into it, in addition to the human value of working rather than not working. I want to go with Leon surely part of the way. The word goals in his terms are a little big for me, but I surely want to pick it up in part by saying I think it's unconscionable, and I don't think inflation has anything to do with it, that young people, especially blacks, low-income, broken families, etc., become available for work at 17 or 18, and we say as a society, we're not going to give them a chance to work. I don't care what the unemployment, what the inflation threats are. We got over $1 billion going into those youths now, and we have to do better than we've yet done to create a work learning environment for those youths. If you really put into that equation the crimes that Senator Humphrey talked about, the vandalism, the alienation, and the thing that I talked about earlier, namely the long-term negativism towards the society, which I pointed out went on in England, you just can't afford not to do it. Secondly, I think it makes no earthly sense to have people on unemployment insurance for 65 weeks. Now, I want to make at least three suggestions here. If you get unemployed because the only plant in your community has closed down and there's no other employment there, I would argue that immediately the unemployment insurance system ought to put you into some form of training or some kind of job search or something, because you're going to sit there forever. because the only plant in that community is closed up. That's all.